Inside Lacrosse Podcast.
I think we're calling it Terry and Dan's Podcast Hour. And we're back for 2016. I mean, so I'm Terry Foy. I'm the publisher of Inside Lacrosse. We're here with Dan Flynn. He is the Director of Events and Business Development in Inside Lacrosse.
That's correct.
And the reason that we're doing a podcast, we're gonna try to do a weekly show over the course of this lacrosse season, focusing primarily, although not exclusively, on Division I men's lacrosse. The reason that we're doing this is because, I am a big sports podcast listener. Among my favorites are the Men in Blazers podcast, the Starters on NBA TV, long-time listener to the Bill Simmons podcast, and I've dabbled in others over time. And the thing that I think, Inside Lacrosse has been doing podcasts for 6, 7, 8 years, and the podcast wave has really crested. I mean, obviously, two falls ago, Serial took everything by storm, whatever. But, now, over the last year to 18 months, even just from, a financial, sponsorship side, podcasts have, exploded. I know you're more of, a comedy podcast guy.
Sure.
Corolla Show, right?
Yeah, Corolla Show, daily, every day I gotta listen to it. And then he's got a couple spinoff shows. He does his Loveline show with Dr. Drew. And he does a...
That's going all the way back to the early 90s.
He has a show with Mark Garagos. It's an attorney to the stars.
He
represented Scott Peterson and Chris Brown, among others.
Who heavy hitter.
They have a podcast called Beyond Unreasonable Doubt. Reasonable Doubt is what it's called. And they do that once a week, and it's a good show. They most recently had a great segment where they interviewed the attorney in the Stephen Avery case.
Oh, interesting.
To get an update on it.
Dean Strang?
It was Dean Strang.
He's the man.
Who does not have a lacrosse sculpture.
It's a hurling sculpture.
Yeah.
Yeah, we got to the bottom of that one.
But great podcast and always funny. And his boy is Bill Simmons. They're all tied in together. Bill Simmons.
Oh, yeah, Carell. And then the Jimmy Kimmel.
Jimmy Kimmel and Cousin Sal. And so there's a lot of updates about that. That's always interesting. But Bill Simmons has always been I've been a huge fan of his.
Well, so why I wanted to do a podcast with you, Dan, is because, over the course of my time at IL, I've done a lot of, relatively, firm-handed, serious lacrosse podcasts. And those are all well and good, right? They've got their place, and I'm sure that there will be a lot more of those, even in this season, as we try to ramp back up into our podcast offerings. But I also think that there's a room for it, and based on the way that my role here has evolved and, based on the way that you watch college lacrosse, there's room for a show that's just talking about watching college lacrosse, right? And we think it'll be a little bit more accessible, and that's what we're going for. So the other thing that I can tell you is that your ability to hold me accountable in terms of preparation is going to mean that I'm coming at this with a more prepared eye than I typically do. And as a result, we have an agenda that we're already about 2 minutes behind on. So we got to dive in. But before we get going, why don't you tell a little bit about what you do here at IL so people have some context as to who you are? Because most people probably have never even heard your name before, unfortunately.
Which in a way is okay with me. I like to be the guy behind the scenes that makes guys like Terry Foy look really good. My role here is to find new revenue streams and to help the business at Inside Lacrosse. And most recently, we focused a lot on our event offerings. I started here in 2008 working on our stadium events and just transitioned into a more participation event model that's been good for Inside Lacrosse. And we're proud of what we're doing, and we're really proud of some of the things we have coming up. You're right. I have a different perspective on lacrosse. I see it more as a fan. I am the guy who graduated from Johns Hopkins and was a varsity athlete there.
But not a lacrosse player.
Yeah.
Important.
And I work at Inside Lacrosse, and I never played lacrosse. I grew up in Delaware. I'm 45 years old. Grew up in Delaware basically in the 80s, and it was impossible to play. Couldn't get equipment. Couldn't get, there was no coaching teams, and I was a football, basketball, baseball guy. But I love the sport. Started working on it as soon as I got to Hopkins in my work study job, and have been involved in the sport since then, really, in some capacity, mostly working in college sports at some of the better lacrosse schools, Washington College, Hopkins, Towson, Penn, some of the places I've been, and then ended up at Inside Lacrosse, as a guy who could help with our event business.
Yep. And so we'll learn a little bit more about you and the bizarre and amazing intersections that your life and career have had with many of the luminaries in our sport as we do this weekly. But we're going to dive in. So, you know, you're going to, anybody that listens to the Men in Blazers or some of the other podcasts that we've already mentioned are probably going to see the influences pretty clearly. And I think, you know, we do want to dive into the games. There's a reason that we're starting this on today, Monday, February 8th, and it is that we have the first weeks of games to react to. But, you know, every week there's always going to be some headlines that we got to follow. You know, those are probably going to be more popular, more numerous at the beginning of the season. So we're going to start with some news and notes.
Yeah, so Terry, there's a couple of things right off the bat that are pretty important. Denver's Jake Nolan.
Yeah. So Jake Nolan is a junior. He's 6'6", 220, 230 pounds. Really big guy. Was a part of their long stick mini depth rotation last year. You know, Denver, the national champion, had three returning starters at close defense in 2015, and then a returning four-year starter at long stick midi. So it was difficult for their poles to break into the rotation. And Jake managed to get himself on the field. He played in all 19 games. But most importantly, so Carson Cannon graduated, and so he was the, you know, second defenseman, and then Mike Reese, the long stick midi, graduated as well. You know, Jake had looked like, alongside freshman Dylan Johnson, who was an Under Armour All-American, that those two guys were going to take the primary step forward in terms of replacing the two guys that graduated. Jake, in my opinion, played a really good game against the U.S. team. He tore his ACL a week prior to last week in practice and is likely to miss the season, as ACL tears usually tend to have happened. So a blow for the Pioneers defense. Was texting with their coaching staff a little bit. I'm bummed as an Ohio guy. Like to see the Golden Bears, Jake's an Upper Arlington alum, do well. But, you know, I think that they're, well, first of all, this is a team that's going to be built on possessing the ball through Trevor Baptiste and playing really, really efficient offense. So, you know, you lose some of your pull depth. It's probably not the end of the world, particularly when you've got some really good talent, but, you know, still a bummer, you know, kind of to come out of the gate with. You know, Connor Reed is another recent ACL injury. Johns Hopkins midfielder who will miss the season as well. So, you know, it happens every year. It's a bummer whenever it does. I don't expect Jake Nolan's loss to be, say, at the level of Tanner Scales, who missed the season for Virginia last year with an Achilles tear. But at the same time, like I said, something that the national champions will be overcoming as their season gets underway.
So while Denver loses one big defenseman, Cornell seems to have gained one.
So it's unbelievable. This is like, and you know, your experience at Penn, you might be able to like shed some light on whether or not my perspective is undue or unjust. But it just feels like such a Cornell thing that, I'll say this, expectations for the Big Red are probably as low as they've been in 5 years heading into this season. You know, certainly they graduated their top four scorers from last year. You know, and that was a team that I think wasn't as good as it had been the previous three or four seasons. So the expectations are that they were going to struggle this year. They had a good faceoff guy, had a pretty good goalie who has been out of the lineup over the course of the run-up to this season as well. And then Chad Otterman, who has been a consensus top 10 recruit his entire prep career, decided to play hockey. He was a Del Barton defenseman, 6'3", 210 pounds. You know, not, he was a Del Barton defenseman. We've seen a lot of those, you know, certainly, Chad Wiedmeyer is the most notable of them, but, you know, they have produced a lot of high quality defensive players. So you kind of, I think, knew what you could expect. But they also have produced some good hockey players, Ned Crotty being one of them. And, Chad Otterman wanted to try his hand at that. Spent last season not in college, so he was a member of the high school class of 2014, spent last season playing you know, the whatever, the
USPHL.
Yeah, you know anything about that?
It's a junior league.
Yeah.
One of the better ones. He played for the South Shore Kings and the Philadelphia Flyers sort of junior team.
Yeah.
They play about 40 games a year.
Yeah. So then he went to Cornell, and he was on the hockey team.
But he didn't see any action.
No,
so
no.
Redshirt?
I don't know. I if I were to guess, by virtue of the fact that their season is still going on and he is already practicing with the lacrosse team, my assumption is that he's left the hockey team. I don't know that for certain. He may be redshirting, and I suppose he could be doing going to both practices, right? Is that? I don't even know how the eligibility stuff works.
Well, he can play both, yeah, for sure. I mean, there's legendary stories of like Deion Sanders or, you
know, James Winston
leaving baseball practice and going over and winning the, you know, 100 meter dash, and then going to football practice. But it'd be a lot for a Cornell guy. I just don't know where the middle of the hockey season, yeah, late hockey season, maybe what he needed to do and accomplish was good enough,
yeah,
and he said, wait, I want to go play lacrosse now, and I'll just continue my red shirt, or maybe he just left the team. Yeah. We have to find that out.
Yeah. So, but either way, he's going to be a difference maker for this Cornell team. You know, I was talking to Ty Sanders about it. He thinks he's going to cover the opponent's top attackman right away. You know, that's a tough ask for a guy who hasn't played competitive lacrosse in over
year,
2 years.
Yeah.
But yeah, we'll see. I mean, and the reason I make that comment about Cornell is because they have been the gold standard in the Ivy League for more than a decade, probably a decade and a half. And, you know, there have been years where, the backslide of the Cornell program has been grossly exaggerated. And that was one of the narratives in the Ivy League coming into this season. And yet here they are, you know, adding talent to their lineup. And that's, you know, before you even get to the fact that number one, I'm sure that there's a lot of talent on the team that just hasn't gotten on the field yet. And number two, they've got a couple of really nice recruiting classes. You know, first their freshman class is there now is pretty good. Their current high school senior class is pretty good as well. And then they've got some really nice kids in the 17 class as well. So, you know, it's not as if it's time to press the panic button in Ithaca. My point is simply that this is going to mute the Cornell's going to struggle point a little bit.
And they're going to need him because the Ivy League is stacked,
yeah,
from top to bottom.
Well, and not only that, but if he's that big, I mean, he's probably going to be a good matchup against Dylan Malloy. You know, and that's, you know, somebody that you're going to be concerned about in the Ivy League is a 6'2", 230-pound Brown attackman who put up almost 100 points last year.
Shifting gears a little bit, Warriors got a new product out that there's very mysterious, a lot of people talking about. I haven't seen it. I don't know much about it. But what can you tell me about the Warp?
All right. So the Warp, it was kind of funny. They were the cover app for the January issue, sure, of Inside Lacrosse. So those of you that got your Wesley Berg graced cover of the magazine, you know, there's a little bit of irony in there. It was a happy coincidence. Westberg has joined Warrior staff and is essentially an advocate, a proficient introduction to the Warrior Warp, particularly. Yeah. No, I mean, I think that's kind of what their thought process was.
Okay.
He's going to help people get used to playing with the Warp. And you've already seen it on the hands of some Denver Pioneers, as well. So, it's an integrated pocket head system. That would be, those are the terms that I would use to describe it.
Have you had one in your hands?
No. Kyle Devitt is the only member of the Inside Lacrosse staff who has had one. And, he really liked it. And I say that with the knowledge that Kyle is like a bona fide, committed stringer. You know, it is not your typical like nylon or leather mesh pocket. It's a different material that I believe is, you know, proprietary to this system. I'll say this. So like the reason that it's important not only because it is a step forward in lacrosse technology. The reason it's important is because there's two schools of thought. Once you know, the streaming community has flourished, has exploded in the last 2-5 years.
Mm-hmm.
And there's aspects of that are very good. I mean, it's a cottage industry, so there's a lot of kids that are making cash off of it. But on the other hand, like, I grew up playing lacrosse in Cleveland, Ohio. There weren't a lot of people that knew how to string a good pocket. I played with terrible pockets my entire career, and I think my performance suffered as a result. And that's because it's hard to do, and there are not a lot of, you know, great stringers. So if there was a technological advance that allowed players that were in the situation that I was in to immediately play with a pocket that performs exactly the way that it's supposed to, that's a meaningful development for our sport.
So who is this intended for? Players at every level or sort of?
Connor Wilson wrote about it on Friday on Lax All Stars, and I thought made a good point, which is that like what this product is now is not nearly what it will be in 5 years. And so the reason that that's true is because it takes time for products to get to the market, right? You know, I would imagine that this is going to be a very in-demand thing out of the gate, probably also limited in terms of production because of the way that it's produced. So it's not like it's going to flood the market immediately. So I think that at the outset, it's meant for a very exclusive lacrosse player, you know, like a very high-end, good player. You know,
a guy like Westbrook.
Yeah, exactly. Or Tyler Pace is a Denver midfielder who's been pictured playing with it. I think that they're, you know, going to make sure that it ends up on some high school fields all across the country with some of the better players that are willing to give it a stab. But I think that over the course of, you know, so for the outset, I think that it's I think the people who are going to buy it are like predominantly like the types of guys who get in line to buy the new iPhone when it comes out. I think that the product is going to have that level of interest. So I don't know how many of those sticks are going to end up like actually on fields right away being used in games, etc. But in a year, in 2 years, when, you know, it starts to become a little bit more widespread, I also think that the product will develop so that it'll go from only being on the Evo head to now being on a lot of different types of Warrior heads, and, you know, potentially Brown heads as well. I don't know what their approach is going to be there. But then, you know, also with the pocket itself, right now it comes in two, like high and mid pocket. I think that there's so much customization that they can provide, you know, kind of like in the way that you like build a mock-up helmet. And so I think that there's a lot that is difficult to predict, but I do think that it could be pretty meaningful in terms of, you know, from the beginner all the way through to the elite player being satisfied with using this as an option.
Couple other news notes from the last week that Terry was out skiing all last week.
I was,
it's,
yeah.
It's nice to have him back. A well-deserved vacation, but it's good to have him back in the office. But while you're gone, Johns Hopkins announced that athletic director Tom Calder has been there for 20 years, really succeeded Bob Scott. Hopkins has had three athletic directors in the last 50-some years or something like that. He's stepping down at the end of the school year. He's going to stay on the staff and transition to more of a development role in central development, but working with a lot of athletics people. But they're going to be looking for a new AD.
Yeah.
And, you know, as a guy who not only went to Hopkins but worked in the athletic department, it's really, this changing of the guard is really the end of an era at Hopkins. And in a way, it's kind of sad for me because
it was an era you were
a part. It's a special place. Yeah, it's a special place. Not that that can change. It could get better. Who knows? But it was really like a family there. The longtime coaches, you know, the baseball coach, the men's and women's swimming's coach, the football coach, the men's basketball coach, women's basketball coach. They've been there for decades.
Mm-hmm.
And Tom Calder was a part of that and kept the ship going and made improvements and helped to build facilities. And it's just, it was sad for me to hear that, but I'm happy for him. He's a great guy and he's done a good job there. But it's really, I guess the thing is, it's becoming more of a business.
Mm-hmm.
You know, even at a school that's predominantly Division III in all but men's women's lacrosse, it's become a business.
So when you talk about somebody that's in this type of position, you know, you have their litany, right? Like the list of accomplishments that stand above the rest. So, you know, certainly a couple of men's lacrosse national championships are
number one.
Are very high on that list. But, I mean, is it number one? Because you join the Big Ten as an affiliate member in men's and women's lacrosse. I mean, just think about that. Johns Hopkins is the first affiliate member of the Big Ten in any sport. This is
and
a conference.
So. We're talking about one of the Johns Hopkins University.
As somebody whose alma mater experienced a conference realignment after graduation, I appreciated the Loyola Greyhounds joining the Patriot League for what it could or could not have done for my post-graduation, the value of my diploma. All right, so you got the Big Ten thing, and then the Cordish Center, which, you know, is a very meaningful step forward for the men's and women's lacrosse programs, for sure, as well as Homewood Field in general and the athletic department in total.
Yeah, so while he's there, I mean, some major things. The Shelley Pavilion, which is the other side of the permanent stands on the other side of Homewood Field, was done in the early 2000s when I was working there, as well as the Rec Center, the Ralph O'Connor Recreation Center, that provided a lot more space. The Cordish Center has allowed some of the other teams to really reap the benefits because lacrosse coaches and team moved out of some of those facilities, making room for football especially to really benefit from that. So it's he's overseen a lot of things. The thing that always amazes me is just how much the athletic department itself has grown. I mean, from a handful of full-time coaches, when I was a student there, I graduated in 93, there was a men's and women's basketball coach, but they had some other assistant coaching responsibility. The football coach was full-time. The head men's lacrosse coach was full-time. Everyone else sort of had some other department, and there were maybe a handful of five other. Now the staff is, seems like there's 100 people that work at Hopkins, and it's sort of that sustained, but the growth of the program, but not too fast. That's, again, part of the statement of how college athletics is going, but also a tribute to Tom Calder and sort of managing that and building that department to where they are now finishing in like the top five of the, the athletic director's cup each year for total sports performance, which is pretty cool.
Yeah. So let's move on to the games.
Yeah, let's talk about the games.
We've been talking about the other stuff for long enough. All right, so there's going to be a thing that we're going to do. So once again, referencing for the third time, the Men in Blazers, when they transition from their news and notes portion to the games, they crack open a Guinness, which would be great, but we're recording this at like 3 o'clock on a Monday afternoon, and yeah, I think that going forward, why don't we, when we got kids listening to the show, whatever, Guinness is a part of football culture. It is not necessarily as much a part of our culture. What is a part of our culture is Chipotle. Because every lacrosse player I've ever met loves Chipotle. And we at Inside Lacrosse happen to exist directly above one. So we are going to crack some chips and guac we begin talking about the games going forward. Would you believe, however, that for the first time in the 8 years that I've worked in this office, Chipotle was closed this afternoon.
4-hour mandatory shutdown every Chipotle store.
Yes. It was unbelievable because, I thought I was like really pleased when I came up with this idea. I was like, oh, it's the perfect fit. It's like a, one-to-one comparison. And then go to buy the chips and guac and the place is closed. It was unbelievable.
But to your point, Terry, we were about to crack the chips and guac and they just reopened.
You're right.
They've had their 4-hour shutdown where they went over the practices and safe food handling. And now they're open again. So let's get right into the game stuff. So a couple of really interesting games for the first weekend of the season. Great to be back. Fun to watch the games. Obviously, there's a huge buzz around Inside Lacrosse this time of year. It's a really fun time. What were your thoughts on the Michigan-Carolina game?
Okay, so it's important to frame this with like the expectations, right? So I think that it's fair to say that Carolina, a lot of unknowns, particularly without Bitter and Sankey. Are they going to be able to score goals? I kind of expected. One of the things, just referencing Denver coach Bill Tierney one more time, he told me that you never are as humbled as a coach as when you are after finishing a scrimmage versus North Carolina, because what always invariably happens is they recruit so deep that you can play toe-to-toe with them, your first 20 versus their first 20, but when you go to your second 20 versus their second 20, there's very little drop-off between their first 20 and their second 20, and it's because it's North Carolina. It's such a great place to play. Those guys that represented the second 20 in scrimmages over the last 2 years are now the starters, right? And so that's the point that I'm making, is that even though we didn't necessarily know, what Patrick Kelly was going to look like as a starter, what Steve Pontrello was going to look like, as an ex-attackman, what Peyton Kluinski was going to do as a repeat performance last year, how Luke Goldstock was going to fit into the mix, certainly didn't even know that Chris Coltier was going to get on the field, they were not. I expected Carolina to struggle to score goals. They did not struggle to score goals. They put up 20. They forced Michigan to replace their goalie at halftime, Gerald Logan, a junior who, was close to 60% as a freshman, missed his sophomore season due to injury, was about a 54% guy last year, and I think was expected that if Michigan was going to take a step forward this year, he was going to be a core component of that. So having to replace him at halftime, Zanino came in, didn't play that much better. I think their numbers were identical first and second half. It's disappointing for if you're a Michigan fan. I think that year five was a year that you expected meaningful steps forward. I don't know whether or not that was more likely to happen at the offensive or defensive end. I do know that Patrick McEwen just tweeted that of the 18 teams that played this weekend, Michigan had the fourth best offensive efficiency, which is meaningful. That's something that you can take a little bit of solace in. Kyle Jackson, you know, 5 goals, play an attack, makes perfect sense. The question is, can they get possession? Because they did not face off very well against Carolina. And then can they get stops if they don't win faceoffs?
Well, Carolina's got a really good faceoff guy.
Yep.
And that surely contributed to it. But what do you, the goalie change at Michigan, like, was it just a, hey, you're having an off day, let's give the other guy a chance?
Yeah,
or
well,
is it you're going to have a platoon system?
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, well, there's probably two things. And I say this realizing, and I think everybody realizes this, that disappointingly this game was not web streamed, so I wasn't able to watch it. Was able to see highlights. There were North Carolina created highlights, so you saw the goals. You didn't see Michigan's saves or stops. So it's hard to say whether or not he just wasn't on point. You've seen that every once in a while. And certainly early in the season, it makes sense. You want to save a goalie if you feel like he's just not having his day. But you want to not make sure, you don't want him to get so shell-shocked that carries into, you know, subsequent games or even into the rest of the season. So, you know, certainly that protection idea was an option. The other alternative is, like you said, this was something that you were planning on doing anyway. It wouldn't be a stunner given that, you know, Michigan has two goalies that have started full seasons. So among the candidates to platoon, they're, you know, they are where Denver was when Ryan LaPlante replaced Jamie Faust. So I don't know. We'll see what the Wolverines decide to do in the goal going forward.
We've seen the goalie platoon work in the past. And Denver's a good example. But I'm one of those guys who says, you know, it's like quarterback. If you got two, you don't really have one. What's your take on it?
I think that there's one additional asset to platooning goalies that doesn't exist for quarterbacks. If you are platooning a righty lefty or a big body little body, I think that I think college lacrosse offenses and offensive coordinators are so sophisticated that they really do a good job scouting opposing goalies. And I think that if you de facto double the workload that both staffs and their players have to do in terms of shoot here on this guy, you are doing your goalie a favor by making him, you know, you have to think of, like, when you're shooting to the scout as an offensive player, you have to think about the scouting report before you release the shot. Unless you get it to the point where it's so innate. You can't really do that if you're preparing for two guys. That's my take. So, generally,
confidence then.
For the goalie or for the offense, or for the defense? Yeah, I don't think I don't think it was for Denver. I think that they just knew their roles. They're like, this is what we're going to do. Particularly because what happened was the way that they did it. So Jamie Faust was a year older than Ryan LaPlante. So I'm sure that there was a seniority component there that made sense. So the fact that he came on in the second half, the fact that he was more athletic and played outside of the crease more, he was able to cause turnovers if they were down. You've seen that, right? Like end of games, you put your more athletic goalie in the crease to double the ball outside of the crease. I don't hate it as much as I hate the quarterback component. I also was a goalie, and the other real big benefit for your team is that if you're only playing one goalie, you have two or three goalies on your roster who just they know that they're not going to get into the game at the start of the game. If you get two goalies who know that they're going to get in the game at the start of the game, you're going to get a better week of practice out of two goalies.
So what's this game say about Michigan? And, you know, they're in their fifth year, and where are they going?
Well, I think what it says is that they are not a tournament team right now. And that probably isn't like a bold declaration. I think that there were a couple of games that, and you know, we'll talk about a few of them, that were that to win set a team up for the rest of their season in a pretty substantial way. And this would have obviously been that for Michigan.
Of course. That was a signature win.
Yeah, I don't think it would have been their first top 20 win in program history. So clearly that would have been an important moment. But generally speaking, I think unfortunately means that, you know, they're status quo. I think that, you know, what we'll see over the course of the next 2 to 3 games for Michigan will determine whether or not there's other opportunities or possibilities for meaningful development going forward.
You think they make the Big Ten tournament right now?
No. Okay. Not with the way Penn State played.
So speaking of another Big Ten team, Ohio State and Furman had a great game, one of the most exciting games of the weekend. What's your take out of that one?
So the first is I expected Furman to be the fourth best team in the Southern Conference, but I expected there to be a pretty substantial difference between them and the three top teams. I expected Furman and Bellarmine and maybe Mercer to be in the mix for that fourth spot behind High Point and Richmond, who I think are going to be very good, and Air Force, who I thought was going to be just a step behind. I think Furman might be better than that. And I think that the primary reason for that is because I think that they have good offensive personnel. I think they can score goals. I think they can run past folks. I thought that Ohio State did not take full advantage. This was the game that I watched the most of. So I watched almost all of this game. I didn't think Ohio State took advantage of its athletic matchups in the way that they probably could have, but there are two aspects to that. The first is, that's a very Ohio State thing to do, and it typically pays off, certainly against Duke in the first round of the NCAA tournament. Last year, that was the case. And by that, I mean, you know, you're not going to go to the goal every single time you have a fast break opportunity. And then the second thing was that Ohio State is really figuring out who they are in a unique way. This is the first time since Nick Myers has been the head coach that they don't have a bona fide star offensively. Carter Brown is a good player, but he is not what Jesse King was, what Logan Schuss was, what Joe Gadel-Garneau was, what Kevin Buchanan was, at least not yet. And I think you kind of saw that both in terms of the way that their scoring was distributed yesterday. The Buckeyes scored 8 goals and did not have a player that put up more than 2 points. And then also by what they tried to do when they came out of a timeout with less than 30 seconds to go with the ball and the game tied. You know, they started with JT Bluba up top in a 1-4, ran a very simple play, got a ball from the wing to a cutting midfielder in the middle of the action who basically was able to score the game when there were 4 seconds off of what was a bounce deflected shot when he was pushed, getting knocked down. It was a crazy play. It was a disappointing play to lose on, particularly if you're one of the almost 1,000 Furman fans that were in attendance. For Ohio State, it doesn't really mean anything, in my opinion, because they lost to Detroit in their opening game last year and ended up getting to the NCAA quarterfinals. This isn't a shocker for me. But like I said, I think it means that Furman is probably, if not comfortably in that cluster of four, you know, I think that they are certainly the favorite to, they are more likely than not to make the SoCon tournament this season.
So you mentioned the pretty good turnout at the Furman game. What was your, that was the game you watched.
Yeah, I did. So,
this is a little segment we're going to have.
Yeah, here. So every week we're going to talk about one thing that we noticed on a broadcast or a webcast that was awesome. And the PA announcing at Furman Stadium was top notch. So the first thing I noticed was, and I was prepared for this because with the Super Bowl, you know, I was curious as to who the first player to dab was going to be. So in the first quarter, they played, is it Show Me Your Dab? Whatever the song is that is the origination, Look at My Dab, is the origination of that maneuver, which is both absurd and appreciated. There were a lot of promos for Bojangles, which just screams Greenville, South Carolina to me in a very positive way. They were raffling off free nights at the Hampton Inn, which I found to be a nice little in-game promotion. The DJ continued to really be top-notch. It wasn't just Look at My Dab. There, I particularly appreciated Everybody Dance Now.
Old school.
Yeah, during that timeout with very little time left on the clock. And then this was the one that I was most mystified by. As a part of maybe the 50-50 raffle or some other promotion, on your way out, you were able to pie a freshman women's lacrosse player in the face.
Got to be a fundraiser, right?
I would assume so, but like,
otherwise, it's sort of a crime.
Assault, I think, is yeah, the crime that you're referring to there, yeah. So I hope they raised some funds. I mean, it was awesome. But I really, really enjoyed listening to the Furman PA announcer.
We got to find out who this person is.
Yeah.
And the DJ, especially. Might be one of the
might
same
be the same
person.
Yeah.
Could be.
Shout out to their quality web stream. You know, I don't know. I want athletic departments to know that crowd noise is okay. If you can't find somebody to do commentary for your game, it's not necessarily the end of the world.
Some more games, first week of February, first weekend in February, and some teams up in New England had a solid game too. BU grinding out a win at home,
yep,
against Providence.
Yep. After their grounds crew had dug out 8 inches of snow, which if they hadn't done it would have been great for us because it's what the February issue of Inside Lacrosse is all about.
I'm looking at it right now.
But props to the Terriers and their athletic department for making sure that game got off.
I was surprised by that score. It was one of the few scores of the week that surprised me a little bit.
In terms of you expected a bigger BU margin?
No. I mean, again, BU, young program.
Yep.
Providence, a a program, in my opinion, is gaining momentum. Mm-hmm. Love their coaching staff, the new facilities. Mm-hmm. It's a lot of positive stuff going on at Providence. And I was just a little surprised by the outcome of that game.
Yeah, so BU, in my opinion, should not be looked at as a new program because they have made strides so quickly. I believe they started 6-0 last year before finishing 6-6, something like that. Seems right. And they have a lot of offensive personnel. And the other thing that surprised me is that, like, in each year of their incarnation, they've had freshmen come in and unseat accomplished, experienced starters at attack that were putting up big numbers. And we saw it again with James Burr coming in and being their leading offensive option after, you know, I believe it was last year, Hilburn was one of their leading scorers. And then year prior, Myers was, you know, one of the kind of excellent offensive players for the Terriers. So I was impressed and not overly surprised by that. But if you continue to do that, it just shows that your program is developing at a really rapid and impressive rate. I agree with you on Providence. I think that they are going to build from the back. And that's why, you know, I would actually say they're probably disappointed to give up 9 goals to BU. But at the same time, it's an impressive accomplishment. You know, they struggled offensively for a good portion of this game. You know, unfortunately, I think that it's going to take a little bit of time for that personnel to fill in, you know, with that staff in such a way that they're going to be able to compete in the Big East on the basis of their offensive talent and personnel. But in the meantime, I do think that they're going to be able to, you know, keep some good teams to low numbers at the defensive end. And, you know, it's one of those situations if you get a couple of nice breaks, you know, you can have you have Georgetown lead you 5-3 at home in the third quarter. I don't know. Something like that. That's where I think that they could pull off a nice win in 2016.
Another significant game down in Annapolis.
Yep.
Two of the academies going at it.
Yep.
Navy comes back to beat Air Force 10-6.
So this was a game that you know, got the full thrust of the Inside Lacrosse staff. Zach Babbo and Christian Sweezy were in attendance. You can check out the Epic Isle Game Day video. Which is a weekly video recap to get their thoughts on the game. Big game for Navy, given that they have Johns Hopkins on Tuesday.
Tough.
Yeah, and then Maryland
on
Saturday.
Tough going for Navy.
So, and it could have been a lot worse, because let me tell you, so they were down 5-2 at half, and I was only able to watch the first half. I switched over to Furman, Ohio State, shortly into the third quarter. And I just thought Navy looked mediocre. Air Force was winning every 50-50 ground ball. Christian Walsh, is that his name? No. Christopher Walsh. Christian Walsh is a different player.
He's a Duke guy.
Yeah. Also from Baltimore. Also a national champion. So Walsh, a sophomore who was one of the best freshmen in the country last year, got the Falcons on the board very early. And, you know, in my opinion, it was crazy because I saw Navy get stops, but I never actually saw them possess the ball. It felt like the entire first half. Apparently, that script flipped over the course of the, particularly in the third quarter, and it sounds like a good portion of that can be credited to Matt Reese, who caused 6 turnovers. So check out Lax Film Room on Twitter because he made a video that included 4 of those caused turnovers. And this dude's ability to get his stick in the passing lanes, both in terms of whether the guy he's covering is throwing the pass or receiving the pass, was top-notch. Picked up 8 ground balls on top of that. And it just felt like Navy sparked their win from the defensive end. They were able to assert themselves at the face-off X. A big win for Navy, particularly because, like I said, I mean, there's a huge difference between they're going to be underdogs against Hopkins and Maryland, no question. If they play those 2 games competitively and lose, and they're 1-2, that's okay.
It's not the end of the world.
Exactly. They're fine. If they lose to Air Force and then play competitively against both those teams but lose and are 0-3.
Yeah, it's a big difference.
Yeah. Yeah.
Big difference.
So, big win for the Mids, particularly being able to bounce back.
Who are some of the other top performances of the week, in your opinion?
Well, so I mentioned Penn State earlier, and Grant Ament was a guy that deserves a mention. 2 goals and 5 assists. This is a kid who we've seen a lot at Inside Lacrosse. He played in the Inside Lacrosse Recruiting Invitational in 2014. He made it very deep into the USU-19 tryouts. And he's a prototypical, quick, slick, smart, dodging from X, feed-first attackman. And I mean, 5 assists in your college debut, particularly for an offense that struggled a lot last year. And I mentioned Patrick McEwen earlier in this podcast. He and I actually spoke a lot about Penn State's offense. And one of the things that he saw being a big asset to Penn State was the two-man game that T.J. Sanders and Dan Crye were going to run together, because they're both accomplished indoor players, and that was going to be one of the things that was going to be a turnaround, a catalyst to a turnaround for Penn State's offense. We can't really get much farther away from two Canadians playing a two-man game on the side of the field to, you know, your traditional ball-carrying quarterback attackman dishing 5 assists. So I was surprised by that, really didn't expect it, and like I said, it coming from a freshman, really impressive. But there were a handful of other performances. 3 face-off performances deserve mention. Kenny Mazza being one. He helped Bryant really dismantle Manhattan. And then there are a handful of other performances that you can vote for in the Inside Lacrosse D1 Men's Player of the Week. Check out that post where the epic IL Game Day video is. It is on page 2. And we, you'll actually, voting might be closed by the time you hear this podcast. But for weeks coming, forthcoming, check out that, that post on Sunday night, and you'll be able to post or be able to vote for the player of the week.
So down at Navy, this is another weekly, segment we'll have is Twitter follow the week.
Yes.
So Terry,
yes.
You know, our guy, Christian Sweezy, just killed it down there.
So Christian Sweezy has had a couple of false starts with joining Twitter in the past, and
he doesn't seem like a Twitter guy.
No, not at all.
But he's very knowledgeable and certainly
worth a follow.
Worth a follow.
And so he fired up his account, fired off about 40 tweets during the game, went from 0 to 200 followers in like 12 hours.
Must be a New Year's resolution.
Really just dominated, just showed everybody what was up with Twitter. And I saw this joke multiple times. I was like, it's kind of fitting that you join Twitter like days before the purported demise of Twitter, which is changing up their format and all that other stuff. So we'll see how much Christian enjoys Twitter.
I've read a lot of his work. He can be wordy, so maybe
this could help his like economy
yeah,
of language.
Like, look, Twitter's going to open things up. It's my platform now.
You say New Year's resolution. It's kind of like the equivalent of like exercise. He's like limiting his. He's using Twitter in the way that like other people use treadmills.
He's working out.
Yep.
Definitely got to follow Sweezy Lacrosse on Twitter. Go check him out. Let's move on. The week ahead.
Yep.
A lot of good games. Tough week for Navy coming up. But a lot of the top 20 teams are mm-hmm. getting into action this mm-hmm. week. So what are some of the games you're looking at this week?
Okay, so Loyal and Virginia have played 2 epic contests since they have started their early season series in 2014. That game in Charlottesville was a Thursday night game 2 years ago. It was probably, I mean,
I remember watching that.
It might have been the best game of the season. Yeah. Ridiculous comeback, overtime, yada yada yada. Internet stream that wasn't holding up.
That was what I remember the most.
Yeah. Although it was great though. It was like one of those things. Like if you could be the only game and you're a decent game, like on a weeknight, people are gonna pay attention and they're gonna talk about it and then it's gonna build it.
I think I remember Casey Vach in particular losing his mind.
He was not happy about the speed of the stream. Keep an eye on Charlottesville for the Greyhounds trip down there. We talked a lot about Furman. We talked about Carolina there taking one another on. Duke's, you know, they do this a lot in February where they play Friday, Sunday, you know, both to get a handful of games under their belt. They like playing these games for the purposes of their young guys. And they also like preparing for what will come later in the season, whether it's the ACC Championship or the Final Four. And so they're doing that. They got High Point on Friday. And again, they are, I believe, the only game on Friday. And then they're 1 of 2 games on Sunday as they take on Lehigh. Believe both of those games are in Durham.
Those are 2 sneaky, tough games.
Agreed. Well, that's the thing is that, like, you know, you've seen these games. Well, first of all, you've seen Duke lose in February. I don't want to say routinely, but more frequently than they lose in March or April.
Yes.
Under John Donowski. And then in addition to that, yeah, I mean, you know, I think that Lehigh is a program that made the NCAA tournament 2 years ago, had some setbacks 3 years ago? Had some setbacks last season. But at the same time, now they're a bona fide program, right? Not a surprise. High Point coming off of a SoCon championship, an NCAA tournament appearance last year. I agree with you. I mean, these are, you know, quality mid-20 programs. And you got to give a tip of the cap to the Blue Devils for making sure that they came out of the gate with a pretty stiff challenge.
And it will definitely be a tough one, especially Lehigh on that second, you know, bounce back day.
Yeah.
2 days later, you're gonna need to have your legs for that one,
right,
for sure. But Gary Gate playing doubleheaders.
It's unbelievable.
It's crazy.
Now, I will say that there are two things about that.
So let's just let everybody know. There's a couple of, early in the season, Syracuse women's team is going to play doubleheader games.
Like two games in one day.
Yeah, against different teams. Not a scrimmage, real games that count, which is...
Aggressive. So I think Syracuse has the biggest women's lacrosse roster by like a factor of 1.7.
Yes.
Which might have something to do with it. And they're also taking on teams that I think expect to be able to...
handle.
Substitute liberally.
Okay.
So they've got Binghamton. Well, actually, that's not even true. So they play Loyola at noon on Valentine's Day, and then they play Binghamton at 7:30. So, I mean, Loyola didn't necessarily comport themselves the way that they would have liked to against Florida, losing 15-6 this week. That being said, it's still not tough. It's an easy game when you've got another game 5.5 hours later.
So how do you schedule your team meals that day? I mean, you gotta eat in between games.
No doubt. I think you probably try to eat as quickly as possible. That would be what I would do.
So no Chipotle.
Our friends at Chipotle probably aren't going to want to hear that. But no, I think you gotta avoid the guac. Maybe just like not a double meat day.
Yeah.
No, I think you go. So they play their first game at noon. You wake up early, right? You probably get out of bed,
go to breakfast.
Yeah,
light breakfast.
7:38. Probably?
Yeah.
Because typically you're going to let your team sleep in a little bit if you've got a 7:30 game. But when you're playing at noon, you got to get going. So then you do the ice and wrap and all that. So you got your – you think you have to tailgate with the parents?
Between games?
Yeah.
No.
Yeah.
In Syracuse – outside in February in Syracuse?
Well, just because it's tailgate doesn't mean it's outside. So what if you're a guy who dates one of the players on the team? You got to go to both games.
You definitely
on Valentine's
have to go. You do.
It's a lot of women's legs. I mean, I guess you'd like it if you're dating a player on the team, but wow. Yeah, 5 hours of Syracuse women's lacrosse on Sunday. Happy Valentine's Day. One more notable thing about the schedule, which is, so if I were coaching a team and I wanted to start late, I would not scrimmage before.
What do you mean?
Regular season games start. Like, I wouldn't have had a scrimmage, not this past weekend, but the one before, because real games start,
nobody pays attention to
scrimmages.
Oh,
anymore.
You're right.
So, like, Notre Dame, they're still, like, a week away. Get this. So, Canisius tweeted on Friday, 30 days from their first game. Canisius men's lacrosse team does not play a game until, I'll pull it up. This is unbelievable.
Wait, they're just on the road.
No. Ooh, maybe they are. I don't know.
They have to play a couple on
First game, March 5th. It's not uncommon that Canisius has been the last team to play a regular season game. But yeah, they don't play until March 5th.
I haven't been to Canisius.
To be a Randy Barron's decision, I would assume. It's just like, they don't play a ton of games. You're allowed to play anywhere between 12 and 17, like scheduled games, and they play...
What's the rest of their conference do? I mean, you said that they're the last team.
Manhattan has already played. Crazy. So, that's my word to coaches. My word of advice to coaches. If you want your scrimmage to exist in a vacuum where nobody pays attention to it. Although, the one exception I will make is that apparently UMBC beat Virginia on Saturday.
And nobody really knows about that.
Well, I guess you're right, yeah. Everybody knows that Marquette lost to Michigan.
Yeah. But it's a scrimmage.
I know, that's what I'm saying. Like,
well, that's why it's the best time of the year. When the real games start.
Yes.
And it's starting to cook up right now. This weekend's going to be a lot of fun. And every week after that, up until Memorial Day.
That's why we're here, to break it down. Dan Flynn, we got one podcast in the books.
Yeah, it feels good.
You pleased?
It's pretty easy. Yeah.
It really is. I mean, it really is just talking.
Yes, it is.
All right. Well, we hope you guys enjoyed it. We want to really increase the amount of interaction with us. So literally just even if you listened and made it this far, feel free to email tfloyd@insidelacrosse.com, dflynn@insidelacrosse.com, just to let us know. And then, you know, maybe next week we'll actually have a question for you guys. You can ask us questions. We'll just, you know, continue to ratchet up the interaction.
All right. Thanks for listening.
Next week, we promise we're going to have like some sort of signature send-off.
Yeah, and maybe some intro music.
Yeah, we'll have a little bit of that.
Some bits.
Yeah.
Have a good week, everybody. Inside the Cross Podcast.